This is Plantagenet Shade, a podcast where we talk history, historical fiction, and everything in between. Oh, and we also throw shade. Hello and welcome. This is the very first episode of Plantagenet Shade, and we are super excited to bring this podcast to you. We'll be talking today about Philippa Gregory's Cousins War series, a set of novels that are set in the War of the Roses era and feature figures and historical events from that era. But first, a bit of background. I'm RK, one of your hosts. I'm also known as Roh Tweets or ROH underscore tweets on Twitter. And if you remember me back from my Tumblr days when we were talking about historical shenanigans, I was Scribbles and Crayon. And joining me is my fabulous co-host, Shell.
Hello, I'm Shell. You may know me from Twitter as Shell1917 or from Tumblr at Grand Duchesa. That's Grand underscore Duchesa. I'm really excited about this podcast and I cannot wait to dive into all of the things we're going to talk about.
There will be a lot of things. We're going to try to keep it short, but we'll see. Before we begin, a caveat. I am not a professional historian. I'm not even an academic historian, nor did I study history in any formal way in college. I'm kind of an amateur dabbler, so if I get things wrong, I'm putting it right out there. Not an expert.
Okay, I'm going to say pretty much kind of the same thing, except I did major in history. And I actually, although I'm not doing anything with it at this point, I do have degrees in history, but, you know, I'll just say this, anybody that knew me then would be utterly surprised that I like anything that's medieval.
So that wasn't your area of emphasis back in the day, huh?
Not in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
How interesting.
In fact, I categorically refuse to take a medieval class.
Look at you now.
I know, right? It only took 10 years.
Well, on that note, the reason we picked PG's books to talk about today is that is how Shell and I first met on Tumblr. We were, I hesitate to say fans, but we were viewers of the BBC Stars series, The White Queen, and we were part of a small group of fans on Tumblr who routinely rolled their eyes at that show, but also sort of unironically loved it. So... that's what brought us together, and it began for me a particular journey into an area of historical fiction I had not really enjoyed before. I knew a lot about the War of the Roses era, but all of my reading had been on the nonfiction side, and getting introduced to this very rich vein of medieval fiction was quite the ride, an adventure.
I am actually kind of the exact opposite of you in that regard. I had not even so much as read a book set in the medieval time frame. My knowledge of the Wars of the Roses or the characters in it was very minuscule at the time I watched the drama series. I mean, essentially, I knew that Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville were Henry VIII's grandparents. Okay. I had watched a little bit of The Tudors, had read back in the day a lot of Jean Plaidy fiction, and I had read The Tudor ones. I hadn't gone back and read her earlier stuff with the, you know, entire Plantagenet dynasty. I still haven't read those. But that was essentially what I had read about those things. So I went into that with like a complete tabula rasa, and then basically the entire next bit of 2013, 2014, a lot of my reading was historical fiction in that vein.
Yeah, it's really interesting how a bunch of people got into it at the same time, and coincidentally, around the same time that Richard III's remains were discovered, or maybe not coincidentally, but I do think that gave the whole group a little bit of a push to read up a little bit more on that era of history. It was very interesting. I remember all the arguments on Tumblr back then, both about the actual historical events and the fiction around it, and how fascinating it was, and just the variety of opinions and very strong thoughts that people had about historical fiction and specifically about Philippa Gregory, but we'll get back to that in a second.
Yes.
Since we're talking about historical fiction, what do you think that term means?
Myself, and I'm just saying this off the top of my head, I've not looked anything up to give me a quote-unquote definition, but I would say it's fiction that is written in or about a historical time period. And I would say
say, for instance, today we would call Tolstoy's Anna Karenina historical fiction, even though it was written during the time period the story takes place. Just the same as we would call Philippa Gregory's work historical.
Right. So the big question there is, does historical fiction need to be accurate? And by accurate, I mean not necessarily accurate in terms of the dates and the places and the names, but in a sort of overall way. And what do people really mean when they say accuracy?
Does it need to be accurate in an overall way? Yes. You need to have the feel of the time period that you are writing in or that you are reading in. Now, does it need to have, as you said, all of the names, dates, all of that correct? Not necessarily. But I also will admit, as a reader, if I am reading something that is in a period that I'm very familiar with, the one that this happens to me the most with is anything that is late Imperial Russia, the Russian Revolution, that stuff. If there are certain things that are wrong about that, yeah, I groan, I roll my eyes, I have thrown books. Did that recently with one, actually, that called the secret police around the time of the Revolution, the Bolshevik secret police, NKVD. No, that's the Stalinist secret police at the Revolution, is the Cheka. And I literally groaned when I read that. So
that is how I am about this period in English history, the War of the Roses. I know a lot about it, and I always get a little upset when people get very small and easily verifiable details wrong. Like, don't mess up the dates and the place names, because those are easy to find. All it takes is Google, you know?
Exactly.
Like, when you mess that up, it takes me out of the whole story, and then I can't enjoy it, and I end up putting the book away and never reading it again. But I think beyond sort of, you know, dates and places, what I worry about is sort of authenticity. Now, obviously, you can't really be authentic because none of us lived in that time period, and we don't know how people looked and sounded, and we only have a very general idea of how they dressed and what they might have eaten and things like that. So in that sense, I don't mind a little bit of invention on the part of the writer. I think what takes me out of a book in terms of authenticity is if the characters' feelings about a particular situation or their reactions to what's happening around them feels a bit too modern. And I don't know why that bothers me, but it does. I don't know that it bothers me to the extent where I can't enjoy the book anymore as it would with like a historical fact, but I do feel like the authenticity of the period is affected by people behaving in a way that's a little too modern.
I completely agree. It is. It is something I notice with certain books, and there are, I know we're talking about PG's books today, but there are certain other Wars of the Roses books, and I can imagine you probably know the exactly ones I'm thinking of right here. Definitely the characters are, I don't know if I would say too modern, but too nice, too perfect.
Yes, so, I know exactly which book you're talking about, and we will get to that one in a future episode, hopefully. But
I figured we would.
Yes. That whole genre of War of the Roses fiction deserves its own episode, I think.
Yes.
Yep. So I do think, and I've had, on Tumblr in particular, and you have experienced this as well, there were a number of people who called out specific books as, not just PG, but specific books as sort of lacking credibility in that sense, right? Like, this person set out to write basically self-insert fan fiction, and it ended up being not at all true to who those historical figures might have been. I would counter that by saying it's fiction and you're allowed to make a certain amount of it up, like for this purpose of entertainment, right? PG herself, in sort of defending her novel, said, I didn't set out to educate people, I set out to entertain them. So I think it's really interesting that someone who actually really does claim to care about how these women are portrayed is also okay with making up most of the facts around these figures, because that's just more fun. Like, you know, history, the dates and places history is boring. We need history to be a really cool story. And I think that's a view shared by at least a small fraction of historians.
I think it is too. And in regards to PG's fiction, if you were thinking of two of the books, and I'm going beyond the three books that make up the White Queen series to say this, but if you look at the book on Jaquetta, Lady of the Rivers, I think I have that title right. I may not have it totally right. And then, of course, if you look at the book on Anne Neville, Kingmaker's Daughter, how much do we really know from the historical record about either of these women? At some point, you're going to have to be making things up. So, I mean, if you're writing it, you're writing a novel. You're not writing a dissertation on them.
Yeah, and that's very true. And what I found as we were researching this episode was that historians, academic historians, have been kind of obsessing about this for almost a century now. I found this really great quote in this old journal article from James Harvey Robinson in the American Historical Review back in 1930. And he said, "History at its best needs not to be simply authentic. Its value as a contribution to wisdom depends on the selection we make from the recorded occurrences and our presentation of them." And then later he goes on to say, "We should be greatly better off had Dickens been scouring the lanes of Jerusalem when Deuteronomy received its final codification. Jane Austen could, from the standpoint of the historian, be advantageously substituted for Margaret of Navarre. Matters cannot be arranged at this late date to suit the historian's needs, but it is clear that the lack of novelists through the ages is a fact he must mourn." So this seems to be going down the route of, if history was told like a story, more people would absorb history. Which brings me to something I really want to talk about, which is, especially with the War of the Roses, but generally with any historical era, the average person's introduction to that era is often through fiction. Maybe it's a TV show, maybe it's a novel. And in that sense, the TV show and the novels themselves become a sort of form of public history. So if that is the case, then to what extent do you think the writer has to be responsible to the viewer or the reader to present an accurate view? And does it not matter at all as long as people are entertained?
I have to think about that for a second. Does it matter? I think it does matter. You do want the accuracy. But if you're looking at reading a novel or watching a television show, your primary objective of that is the entertainment. So you want to make sure that your audience is entertained by what they are watching, what they are reading, because if they're not, they're not going to come back. I mean, I may read a novel by somebody. I'm one of these people that doggedly finishes just about everything I read, even if I despise it. But if I have despised one work by this person, I'm not going to go back and read a second novel by them. If I have watched one or two episodes of something and it doesn't hit me, I'm not going to watch the whole season more than one. So you want to you want what you do to be authentic, but you also want, in order to obtain an audience, you want it to be entertainment.
So really the best historical fiction is the kind that is broadly based in history, but is mostly entertaining.
More than likely for most people, yes.
Okay.
And I'm saying that as a caveat for most people, because, you know, I've read big, gigantic historical epics. Sharon K. Penman is one of my favorite authors. You know that. And her stuff is, to me, at least right now, the pinnacle of historical fiction, because it is both well-researched, for me, authentic to the time, and highly entertaining. Which so everybody's hook, mileage right? may vary on that.
Right. No, the story has to be good. I think that is undeniably true of every kind of medium that is intended for popular consumption, right? If it's not fun, no one's going to want to read it. And I use fun loosely. Some of these stories are not happy ones, but as long as they are good to read, we are entertained by them. I am just taking the view that I remember having these conversations earlier about works like Philippa Gregory's books that weren't necessarily historically accurate, and whether she had failed in her responsibility as a potential public historian because the people who were drawn to those facts actually believed them, right? Like, if you right. read The White Queen and you come away thinking there was a real possibility that Elizabeth Woodville was some kind of medieval witch, have you done Elizabeth Woodville a disservice? Or is it okay to believe that about someone who's been dead for 500 years and a fact that is not verifiable one way or the other, right?
Yeah, it's not verifiable. You cannot say Elizabeth Woodville was a witch. Technically, you also can't say she wasn't.
Right.
You can't verify that. Unless somebody, if it's a time machine and you go back to 1460s England, then you might be able to verify it.
And even then, maybe not. I mean, what are you going to do? Weigh her on one of those balances?
Right, exactly.
So do you think that, in a way, because it's entertaining and because it tells stories better, we can use historical fiction as a sort of bridge between the dry, you know, dates and places kind of history that academic historians like to talk about and the more entertaining, you know, sort of stuff that happens on Game of Thrones? Like, historical fiction exists somewhere in the middle of all of this in the sense that it's fun, like a great TV show, but it could also potentially be educational. Like, I know that I read years ago when I was still in college, Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth. And as a result of that reading, I went off and got really interested in that particular area of history and I learned a lot about it, but not everyone is going to do that. So in a sense, I think that the historical fiction writer needs to view their work as a sort of chronicle of that time. So it does need to be somewhat accurate because it might be the only time a particular reader ever accesses that period of history. I'm not going to say they have a responsibility to do that, but I think it would be good if they did.
I actually think a good historical fiction writer does that anyway. I think a good historical fiction writer realizes that what they write may be the only thing that person, the reader, knows about the era they're writing in. Or it may be the gateway for the reader to research more about that era. So I think if you are writing historical fiction, you're publishing historical fiction, then ideally, and I probably should stress ideally there, ideally you take the responsibility of trying to make it as accurate and as entertaining as you can, but you also realize you're walking a tightrope in doing so.
The reason I brought this up is because the tagline to this podcast is history as fiction. So we're kind of both believers in the idea that a lot of history told fictionally is more interesting, but also really useful. And I think that's a really good segue into Philippa Gregory and the Cousins War series. So we're going to talk we're going to specifically focus on the books that we have both read, The White Queen, The Red Queen, and The Kingmaker's Daughter. The White Queen is about Elizabeth Woodville. The Red Queen is about Margaret Beaufort, and The Kingmaker's Daughter is about Anne Neville. These three novels were the ones that were adapted into the Starz and BBC production, The White Queen. So when did you first read these books? I read The White Queen when it was first published, and I think it's actually the first of the books in this series to be published, and I think it came out in 2008 or 2009.
Technically, I think it is the first one. They call it the first one. It or Lady of the Rivers is the first one in the series now. But I don't think they were published in that order.
Because no, I think White Queen came out first.
Well, then, in this order of White Queen, Red Queen, Kingmaker's Daughter, yes. I'm sorry, I think I misunderstood what you were saying there. But if you look at the books as they are listed now, they're listed as the Tudor and Plantagenet novels.
Right.
And some of the other books in that, Constant Princess and some of the others were published prior to. So the order of the books, if you look at them now, are not the order of the publication.
Right, right. I think they're now listed in chronological order based on the events that happen in the books. But I think all the Tudor novels came first. And then there was The White Queen, The Red Queen, Kingmaker's Daughter, and The White Princess. And The White Princess kind of transitions from the Plantagenet era into the Tudor era. And the Lady of the Rivers is actually sort of the prequel to The White Queen, since it deals specifically with Jacquetta of Luxembourg. When did you read the books?
Actually, I did not read them until the middle of the miniseries airing. Oh, cool. I was looking today on my Goodreads, and I actually kind of sped read through White Queen and Kingmaker's Daughter today also. And I read all three of the books, I think, in July of 2013.
Oh, cool. So I had read The White Queen, as I noted before, but I only made it halfway through the book because I was so annoyed by what I thought were Philippa Gregory's taking liberties with the historical events, if you will. I was very serious about what the history was at the time, and I felt kind of cheated by the book, so I stopped reading it halfway through, and I did not pick it up again until after the series, at which point I also read The Kingmaker's Daughter and The Red Queen. I have not read the other books in this series, and I have not read the Tudor novels, though I know of them. So there's The Constant Princess, The Other Boleyn Girl. All of these have been made into major Hollywood productions, so I think people are aware of their existence.
I've read about half of the other books. I've not read the ones that go up into Elizabeth I and that. I've read the
that about half of the others. And I have unfortunately read The White Princess. Experience we're not going to go into because that is one of, yeah.
I have read it too, but we are not going to talk about that book for reasons. For reasons that the Ride or Die crew will be well aware of if they're listening.
Exactly.
But anyway, which of these three books that we talked about, so The White Queen, The Red Queen, and The Kingmaker's Daughter, is your favorite?
I'm still going to have to go with The Kingmaker's Daughter.
Why?
I think it probably does go to me watching the series, being primarily invested in Anne and Richard's story. And it's, now I have issues with that book, big time issues with that book now. And the portrayal of them and the portrayal of Richard especially. But it still is the one of the series that I find that I like the best. Mainly because, again, I can find Anne to be a little bit more sympathetic than I do Elizabeth Woodville or Margaret Beaufort. I would love to read a better novel on Margaret Beaufort, to be honest, because she's fascinating. But yeah, it's, for me, it's still Kingmaker's Daughter. I mean, if you notice when I said when I read through, I said I did The White Queen and Kingmaker's Daughter. I tried to do The Red Queen. I couldn't do it.
So I find it so interesting that, okay, she, Philippa Gregory has been really, really open about the fact that she was trying to write these novels about these women who had been basically relegated to the footnotes of history, right? They were not right. on their own really important. They were only important because of who they were married to, and they didn't go off and do great things themselves, and therefore they're not really talked about in history. And she was very keen on bringing those women to the center of the stage. And in particular, she really wanted to highlight Jacquette of Luxembourg, who she felt was a really, really interesting person in a more modern sense, right? Like, she was a minor noble who ended up being married to a royal duke, the Duke of Bedford, Henry VI's uncle. And after she became widowed, and despite not seeking royal permission, she went off and married this relative nobody in Richard Woodville, in a marriage that was both secret and somewhat scandalous at the time, right? So when you see her from a modern perspective, she does seem like this woman who has so much agency and power. And she's, you know, even though she's not particularly influential, she's out there and she's at the all the important historical events, and she is somebody who stood up for herself, right? And I think that is a really interesting thing. But what I find even more interesting about what Philippa Gregory does in this book series is that she takes facts from history that have been noted by contemporary chronicles, right? The fact that Jacquette of Luxembourg and Elizabeth of Woodville were descended from Melusina was the thing that allegedly gave them their sort of powers, their supernatural gifts. And this was noted, but it was noted by people who were detractors of the Woodville family, right? Warwick and George of Clarence and later Richard III used this information against them to make Elizabeth Woodville look bad. Philippa Gregory takes that fact, and honestly, I have some grudging respect for how she does this, but she totally subverts it by making that the central premise of the story, right? Like the audacity of it, it really impresses me. And I didn't feel this way back in 2013, but I do now, which is, okay, so she took a known but not very well understood fact about one of these characters, and she made it the whole point of the story. And in The White Queen in particular, we see that Elizabeth Woodville relies on these powers not necessarily to do bad, but to protect herself, right? So in the beginning, when she first encounters Edward, she is trying to make sure that she will get her inheritance from her dead husband so that her sons will be taken care of, right? And so she doesn't...
Which is also what the historical record says, too. It says that she encountered Edward trying to take care of the lands that she should have had being a widow.
Right, and that's perfectly a normal way. Of course, Philippa Gregory's books and, in fact, other novels set in this era turn it into a very romantic first sort of meeting where there's this giant oak tree and Edward first encounters her under the oak tree and she's the most beautiful woman he's ever seen, et cetera, et cetera. But whatever the romantic facts might be, the fact remains that she approached Edward essentially not because she was trying to entrap him, but because she needed help having her estates restored to her, right? And that is a totally legit reason to meet the king. Whatever happens next remains shrouded in the annals of history. Nobody seems to know how exactly these two got together. when they got married, if they even got married, no one knows, right? It was just Edward showing up one day at court and being like, yeah, by the way, I got married, right? And he waited five months.
Basically like, yeah.
He waited 5 months to tell people about this. So I do think that in his case, it was merely, it wasn't politically expedient when he married her, and when it became politically expedient, he told people about it, right? He was very smartly playing this game. I don't think it was this torrid love affair where he couldn't help but marry her. I think it was all very calculated. But the book doesn't go into that. The book rather takes the approach that realizing that her future and the future of her family might lie in a closer alliance with Edward, she kind of invokes the river goddesses, if you will, and has her way with him. And then later she does the same thing when she believes that George of Clarence, having married Isabel and about to have a baby, is a threat to her position as queen and to Edward's throne, and she conjures up a storm that results in Isabel having a shipwreck and losing her baby. It is recorded that on their return from Calais, the kingmaker and his family were shipwrecked. So that part is true, but to make Elizabeth kind of responsible for it gives her an agency she doesn't have in history. And I sort of admire Philippa Gregory for doing that. Like, Elizabeth Woodville is a woman who is stuck at home doing nothing. And so she gives her something active to do via this whole witchcraft subplot. Same thing with the Battle of Barnet, right? Like, the right. First time I read this, it was absolutely ridiculous that she conjured up this fog to cause confusion at the battle. Although it is a historically known fact that there was in fact fog at the battle and that the Lancastrian forces ended up attacking each other because they couldn't see. So I do think it's kind of clever for her to put Elizabeth Woodville center stage at events she would otherwise have had no control over.
Well, going back to Warwick's family and the storm off the coast of Calais, it is also said at that time that Isabel did lose a baby then. But it's not, I don't believe it's totally said if the baby was a boy or a girl. They don't know. But she did lose a baby at that time. Also, again, with the whole Barnet thing, the Battle of Barnet is honestly truth being stranger than fiction.
That's true.
I mean, really, would you write, if you were writing a novel and you were writing a battle and you're just, say you're writing in a fantasy realm, would you really have fog come up, confusion in the battle of who is who, and then one of your commanders kill one of your other commanders? No, you wouldn't.
But it actually happened.
Exactly.
But for her to take that thing that actually happened and make Elizabeth responsible for it was the only way she could put Elizabeth in the battle scene, right? So that's right. Why she does it. And as a writer and as a reader, I really respect that, even if as a lover of history, I kind of had to roll my eyes and laugh out loud at that bit, right?
Yes. I actually, the use of Elizabeth's powers in the novel that I find more interesting, and this is, again, me having sped read through them today, the whole thing with, after her father and her brother are executed by Warwick, and she has the locket and tears off the bit of her father's last letter, writes Warwick and George's names on it, and it's basically like, I'm playing a long game here. I'm getting revenge against the two of you. And then Warwick dies at Barnet. Her fog. If you're going from the novel, her fog. Warwick dies. Okay. And then, again, playing the long game and George's execution in 1477.
She doesn't seem to have had any active role in that. So that was mostly George becoming, like, crazy enough that his brother needed to get rid of him, right?
But, right, exactly. I mean, that's what I think it is. It's George basically becoming crazy enough that Edward had no other choice. However, if you take it and do not like Elizabeth, you can also argue, well, maybe Elizabeth put this into his mind and he's doing this because of his wife. Or if you take the point of the particular Bishop Stillington, am I getting his name right? Of him also being arrested around the same time as George. He's held and then he's set free. Well, if you take the idea that what is revealed in 1483 by Richard III is true, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Who knows? Nobody knows at this point. You cannot know. But if you take it that as being true, well, maybe Elizabeth found out about that. Maybe Elizabeth sees George as a danger to their future, to the future of her children. So, George has to die.
do you find it interesting that PG doesn't explicitly say any of that? She doesn't explicitly make Elizabeth responsible for those deaths, but she does open the door to people speculating about whether Elizabeth did it, which I find really interesting because Elizabeth is the protagonist of this novel, and yet she's okay with having her be maybe a pseudo bad guy. And if you look at it from the perspective of the other characters who are in the other novels, and remember, all of these novels are told in the first person, so we only get the limited point of view of the main character, right?
Right.
Both Anne Neville and Margaret Beaufort are, at one point or another, genuinely afraid of Elizabeth. And I find that so fascinating because it keeps you from sort of fully sympathizing with Elizabeth Woodville, even though we understand her motivations and we are scared that she won't get what she wants. We also don't really want her to get what she wants because maybe she's not a good person. I mean, whatever her motivations for creating the storm that causes that shipwreck, all of those people could have died. It's not just the death of that baby. She could have had Isabel's death and Anne's death and George of Clarence's death on her conscience, right? And
right.
And Philippa Gregory says, I'm just putting that out there. You make up your mind. And I like that. I like not being told how I should feel about the character. So.
But on the other hand, also, if Warwick and George had not rebelled, would they have been on that ship to Calais? No, they wouldn't have. On the other hand, you can put the baby's death and anything that happens on the shoulders of George and Warwick.
Right, because they are, and I think it's weird to me that Anne and Isabel both become very fixated on this whole concept of Elizabeth Woodville basically committing sorcery to ruin their lives and forget mostly that their father's overarching ambition is part of the problem, right? I find that really
But if you are, sorry, as you are in the case of Anne, basically what we would in modern terms call daddy's little girl, do you really want to admit that daddy did anything wrong? Can you bring yourself to admit that? The character of Anne as Philippa Gregory portrayed her, no, she can't.
So let's talk about Anne for a bit. She's really interesting because she's the one who's almost her entire life you get to see over the course of the book, from the time she's a little girl all the way up to her death, ultimately. And she does start out as very much this sort of pampered little princess, daddy's little girl. You know, she wears rose-colored glasses. She goes to these parties. She eats the whitest of bread, as she notes herself. She is a little princess. Her father's not king, but she's about as close to a little princess as you can get in that world, right? Her family.
Well, her father is the richest man in the realm.
Right.
So.
They're fabulously wealthy, and he's extremely influential, and now his cousins are about to take the throne, and she's about to move even closer to the corridors of power. But she doesn't seem to appreciate any of that because, frankly, she's too young, right? Like, she's still kind of seeing the world the way a little girl who grew up on fairy tales would, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that all comes crashing down around her so quickly at the time of her father's rebellion.
Yes,
it is that sort of fantasy falling away from her eyes that was the most stark and like touching part of The Kingmaker's Daughter to me.
I agree. And that's actually, because I say that's the book I love the most, and it is, but I'll be honest, I often skip over that part because I want to read the Anne and Richard stuff, even though it's not my favorite fictional Anne and Richard. But it is, it's the total, just everything that she thought was true is basically yanked away from her. Their allegiance to York is yanked away. York aligns himself with Margaret of Anjou. He aligns himself with Margaret of Anjou. She ends up married to Edward of Lancaster.
Who is a terrible person, of course.
Well, yeah, according
this, to, in this
know,
book.
In this book, and according to, you know, Yorkist propaganda, who knows what he really was? There's no way to know.
The nicest guy, we have no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think about the fact, so there is, in many chronicles, this notion of Anne, following the Battle of Tewkesbury, now a widow, reaching out to the king to have some of her property restored to her, failing to really make an impression on him, ending up being sort of imprisoned by her brother-in-law in the sense that she's a ward of the Duke of Clarence and he doesn't seem interested in restoring her to any of her rights. And then sort of leaving him to go to either run away to this cook shop or just to be there so that she doesn't have to be under George's power anymore. And then, of course, being rescued by Richard. This appears to have been a true event, but it is not covered in The Kingmaker's Daughter, which I found really, really interesting. Like, she does not have the whole cook shop incident. And that was a strange choice to me on the part of Philippa Gregory, because she's otherwise so invested in getting these characters to stand up for themselves and to do things that would mark them out as rebels who will do whatever it takes to get what they want, right? But Anne doesn't do
also,
that.
Also, look at Gregory's portrayal of George of Clarence. She puts George and Richard still somewhat, at least, close together after Richard and Anne's marriage. Most other authors put the marriage of Richard and Anne as a breaking point between George and Richard. She does not do that. There is no real breaking point between George and Richard. Yeah, there are scenes where Richard seems completely exasperated with George, and no wonder who wouldn't be. But there's not a true breaking point between them. But most other authors also choose, instead of Anne running away to the cook shop on her own, George imprisons her there. And Richard has to rescue her because she is the damsel in distress.
So, in a way, she avoided that by making Anne basically approach Richard and be like, why am I suffering like this? And he says, well, you don't have to suffer. You can marry me, right? So,
right.
He offers her an out and she takes it. Whether she's actually in love with him or not seems to be besides the point. And maybe, I think in The Kingmaker's Daughter, there's the suggestion that a very young Anne was quite taken with the much younger Richard at that point. But as they grew up and got older, they had sort of drifted apart and did not see each other again until the Battle of Barnet, where she encounters him again, and he's obviously somewhat taken with her. Although, again, Philippa Gregory plays it kind of cool by not ever letting us know whether Richard's feelings for Anne are sincere or just motivated by his desire for money and power. Both of those things could be true, but in the eyes of Philippa Gregory, we'll never know what's really true. And Anne spends quite a lot of the book worrying about this herself. She has been introduced to this concept of the Wheel of Fortune by Margaret of Anjou, and she believes very strongly in the concept, right? Like, she's like, right. Oh, the Wheel of Fortune is turning, and now I'm at the top, and later I'll be at the bottom. So she's kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop all the time, and she's a very, very insecure woman.
Her deathbed scene is her telling Elizabeth of York about the Wheel of Fortune, and that, you know, Elizabeth, to her, seems to be riding high on it at that moment, but there may come a day when Elizabeth is on the bottom side of the Wheel of Fortune.
So yeah, it kind of dominates her entire life, the Wheel of Fortune. You know, she loses a husband but finds another one. She is able to come into some level of money and influence, but she's also sort of relegated to the North, where, you know, she gets to live her life in peace away from everybody else, but she's no longer at the sort of center of power. And I think that's a valid choice on her and Richard's part, but it's also supposed to reflect them deliberately removing themselves from court, and we don't quite see that in either the TV series or the novels, where Richard remains quite closely associated with his brother the king and with happenings at court, but Anne herself is somewhat isolated and doesn't have a good idea of what's going on. And of course, in the novel, and this may be because she didn't have access to this information when she wrote it, there's this idea that Richard deliberately married her without getting the appropriate dispensation so that it could be annulled later.
Yep. Right. And Anne doesn't really realize that until her mother very helpfully tells her that. I mean, her mother, as portrayed in The Kingmaker's Daughter, is not going to win any Mother of the Year awards.
Actually, none of the moms, right? Maybe Jaquetta, but Elizabeth of York hates her mother. Anne Neville hates her mother. Margaret Beaufort hates her mother. And all of these people have good reason to hate their mothers. Like,
yes.
Jaquetta is the only one who comes off as a decent mother figure. All of the other mothers are terrible. Anne Beauchamp, Countess of Warwick, is an awful, awful person who runs away just when her daughter needs her. Margaret of Bledsoe actively neglects her daughter except when she needs to make a powerful marriage for her. And yeah, Elizabeth Woodville does not always do right by her children. So it is fascinating to me that all of the parent figures, and even Cecily, Duchess of York, who in real life is an extraordinary woman, comes off pretty poorly in these novels, right?
Cecily Neville, Duchess of York, comes off as caring about nobody except for George Clarence.
Right? Which is odd to me, but And not in keeping with the historical fact, which is she very deliberately removes herself from all of these power things because she wants to be a woman of piety. And she also recognizes that she's already lost a husband and a son and all of these people. I think she knows from the get-go that her family is basically doomed. And she sort of wants no part of that.
I think yeah, I agree. She doesn't.
And Margaret of Anjou also comes off really poorly, where I think she's such a fascinating woman. And it's so interesting to me that of all of the women she could choose to write about, the one that Philippa Gregory really, really cared about was Jacquetta. The others didn't yes. matter that much to her. Like, Margaret Beaufort is a fascinating woman. She is, from a modern perspective, the person we should admire the most just for surviving all the rubbish that happened to her. And yet, in Philippa Gregory's books, she's just reduced to this obsessive religious fanatic, right? Like, she's not interesting. And I don't know how you take somebody like Margaret Beaufort and make her not interesting.
Margaret Beaufort could be utterly fascinating. I mean, this is a woman who gets pregnant at 12 or 13, has one child, because honestly, the birth for that was probably so horrific that she couldn't have any more children. She marries again. She ultimately manages to put her son, who was probably the farthest person from the throne, she ultimately manages to put him on the throne. And then she goes on to live throughout his entire reign. And, you know, she's my lady, the king's mother.
Right. She survives through four reigns of power where she's only loosely connected to the throne and where at any point she could have lost everything. But she is so good at kind of testing the political winds and knowing which way to sway to get what she wants. And she does all of this to protect her son, and that's perfectly appropriate. I'm 100% behind her for that. I just find it interesting that as a writer, Philippa Gregory did not care about all of that, right? Margaret is traumatized by the things that have happened to her, the suicide of her father, the neglect of her mother, her first marriage, which she seems to have had sort of a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing going on, where her husband was not an especially nice man. I mean, he impregnated a 12-year-old girl, so make of that what you yeah. will. But she's obsessed with being the mother of this child, right? This is her only child, and she's going to do whatever she can to help him survive. And then there's the whole suggested romance with Jasper Tudor, which does not seem to have any basis in history, but does provide those novels with a little bit of a romantic hook. The one part of The Red Queen I liked was her realization that her husband, Henry Stafford, was actually a nice person. And she realizes it so late after she sent him off to battle and he comes home almost dead.
Mortally wounded.
Yes. And then, you know, her tears at that point are so powerful and her sense of guilt is so powerful. And I think it's too bad that the writing doesn't explore that a little more, because it makes her a more interesting person. Because then she goes right back to being, well, who can I marry now to ensure that my kid is safe, right? Like, and that's how she ends up with Stanley. But
yes, Stanley, who is the ultimate survivor of everything and switches sides like no one's business.
Hey, in a way that makes him the perfect husband for Margaret Beaufort. I mean,
yeah,
she needed somebody who was close to the king, but who was perhaps unscrupulous enough not to let those loyalties bother him. And honestly, the War of the Roses is all about constantly shifting loyalties, right? These people's sense of loyalty is built on a bed of sand. It is not going to hold up. And I think Richard III's great failing may have been that he valued loyalty above a lot of other things. And meanwhile, everyone around him is like testing the wind all the time, right? They're not steadfast. They're not committed to any one thing. They're just constantly out there looking to make personal gains. And I think Edward IV would say, well, that is the way of the world. That is how you should live.
Yes.
What can you do to put money in your own pocket? That seems to have been Edward IV's motto. And if I have to point to something, I have to say that the male characters in these books, despite not being in focus, are actually really fascinating, all of them. Whether we're talking about somebody who is sort of the virtual mustache twirling villain like Stanley, or Edward himself, or, you know, his brothers, or the Earl of Warwick. I mean, they're all just fascinating people. And it's funny because they have so little time on the page, but they do stand out.
But the thing of it is, historically speaking, they all seem to be larger than life. If you read the historical information on them, they like leap off of the page. Yeah, as I said, when when we were discussing how we got into the books, the only thing I knew going into was that Elizabeth Woodville, Edward IV were Henry VIII's grandparents. Well, if you look at Edward's personality and look at his grandson's personality, they have a very similar personality.
And they were literally larger than life, right? They were huge men.
Literally.
Yes. Edward IV, in his armor, was allegedly, like, so large that men would basically run scared when he rode onto the battlefield, which explains why he never lost. no, seriously, like, imagine that. Imagine that. Like, a man who with his armor on is probably, like, 6'6" on a horse, like, bearing down on you. You would pee your pants and then die.
And you would. Even though I think we picture the idea of the medieval war horses as being huge, humongous horses, and there actually has been historical evidence lately that has shown, no, they really weren't. Which, again, is like, okay, how did they carry these knights in the armor if they're not these huge, gigantic horses? But if you picture in your mind, as we all probably always have, this huge, gigantic horse carrying this huge, gigantic man in armor, yeah, we're all going to run away scared from that.
And on top of that, I have this abiding image, and I don't think it's from this show. I think it's from something else, maybe one of the Shakespeare remakes on BBC. But Edward IV is on horseback in armor, and as he bears down on his enemy, you see the sun shining behind him. It might even be Sharon K. Penman describing it in The Sun and Splendor, actually, and that's where the idea of
I was about to say that might be SKP.
Yeah. And of course, that's where he's the sun in splendor, because there he is, you know, knight in shining armor with the sun literally behind him, like beaming onto the world. And I think the romance of that moment is captured really well in The White Queen, in the scene where Elizabeth first encounters Edward.
Under the tree.
Him
riding up in the armor. And the thing that is interesting to me, if you compare the book to the show, in the book, it's Hastings that's with him. It's William Hastings that's with him. In the show, it's Warwick. And the show eliminates so many of these the other historical people that were around Edward, were around Richard, and or combines people together.
And I think that's sort of necessary, because there are probably limits to casting and things like that. But I do think, like, if you start to drill down and look at the real history, then Hastings is a supremely important figure.
Yeah, and Hastings
is not in the context of these novels. He's not especially important. And also, Elizabeth kind of hates him because of the whole Jane Shore thing, right? So
right.
I think in that sense, his elimination sort of paved the way for her to be a more active agent of her own life. So we've talked a little bit about things that Philippa Gregory did well. Are there things that she didn't do well, or things that you particularly did not like about the characters or the writing?
I would just have to say almost the entire majority of the Red Queen. I have no feeling for Margaret Beaufort in that book. I really don't care. And she just makes Margaret Beaufort into this completely unsympathetic character. But you are writing a character who, again, I'm going to stress this again, got pregnant at 12 years old, had her child at 13, had no more children. Remember this so much that she counseled her against her granddaughter being sent to Scotland when she was around 12 or 13 years old to be married. Yet you don't make this woman into a sympathetic character. Why?
That's what I don't understand. I honestly don't think that as a writer, she especially liked either Anne Neville or Margaret Beaufort. I think she liked Elizabeth. I think she really, really liked Jacquetta. She did not like these two other women. She felt compelled to write about them because it was impossible to tell the stories of Henry Tudor and Richard III without talking about these women who are important to their lives. And so that's why The Kingmaker's Daughter exists, and that's why The Red Queen exists. But I don't think she liked them. And I think she especially did not like Margaret Beaufort, because she, in the books, she does broadly suggest that in cahoots with Stanley, Margaret Beaufort may have engineered the whole Princes in the Tower saga. But she also suggests equally that Anne Neville might have done it because she was nervous about her own child's future. The person she doesn't blame is Buckingham, weirdly, who had something to do with all of this, but
except that when Anne is dying, Anne goes to the one who was the warden of the tower,
Brackenbury.
Yes, thank you. I knew his name started with a B. I could not come up with it. And she goes to him because she had suggested to him, well, maybe. And he's like, no, I couldn't do it. I didn't do it. And she's like, okay, I can die in peace. I know I don't have to confess this.
Well, that's also because we see at the end of The White Queen that Elizabeth Woodville actually dispatches one of her children off to France, right? So that,
right.
That's so that she can bring the Prick and Warbeck story into The White Princess when it ultimately happens.
And when Anne is on her deathbed and she's talking with Elizabeth of York, she realizes that Elizabeth of York knows something.
You're right.
That Elizabeth probably knows either one or both of her brothers are still alive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I'd completely forgotten about Anne's deathbed confession scene with Elizabeth of York, where, of course, at that point, she believes that Elizabeth of York has displaced her at Richard's side, right? Like, she's convinced they're having an affair. And in the Philippa Gregory novels, they actually are. Oh my God, I cannot get over that little bit of sort of gap filling of history. I know that there were contemporary rumors that this was happening, but they were rumors. And to take that and turn it into fact really kind of upset me.
For those who do not realize this, and because I need brain bleach for the idea of this, I'm going to start stepping here. Richard III is Elizabeth of York's uncle.
Uncle.
Therefore, we are talking about uncle, niece, incest. If I need brain bleach for this, I'm sorry. Everybody else is going to need brain bleach for this.
That's right. Why suffer alone?
And that, oh my gosh, I remember when we all were watching the miniseries, and those who have watched both the BBC version and the Starz version know that there are differences in that. One of the main differences that comes to mind is the fact that in the BBC version, there's nothing going on between Richard and Elizabeth.
Yes, it's vaguely suggested, but nothing more than that. So.
There's nothing more than a kiss. When the Starz version, there is no doubt. That's all I'm going to say on that.
Although, if I remember correctly, the only saving grace of that scene is how upset Richard looked about the whole thing, right? Like, he was not into it. So...
You could honestly say that he rides into battle the next day and basically commits suicide over it, okay?
Oh, and so I'm just going to bring up this one point about the show. One thing about it that was really nice was that it was filmed in Bruges, which does do a reasonable, is a reasonable facsimile of 15th century England, I guess. The interiors are very authentic. The sets feel authentic. But then you have the weird, like, cheaply made costumes. These are the richest women in England. Margaret Beaufort, Elizabeth Woodville, the actual queen, and the kingmaker's daughter, whose father is, like, richer than sin, right? And all of them have, like, three dresses. Like, how does
Anne's
this happen?
Green dress. Anne's green dress with the fur lining on it that she wears from 1471 until she becomes queen in 1483.
When she finally gets that new brown dress, right? So.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I don't understand why I understand why she was wearing it at the Battle of Barnet, and then later, you know, when she went to see the king, maybe she didn't have any clothes left. Maybe all her,
right.
her luggage train was lost, all of that kind of good stuff. But then she marries the Duke of Gloucester, is the wife of one of the richest men in England, and has... like two other dresses. It doesn't make any sense.
Her coronation dress
is the same one that she wears at her wedding to Edward of Lancaster.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Like, I mean, what was the show doing with its costuming? It was crazy. And then the weirdest, worst offense was that the Battle of Bosworth, which happens in England in a field in August, happened in the woods in the winter in Belgium with snow on the ground. Like, come on.
I mean, could they not have found a way to melt the snow at least?
No, or at least film in an open field. So, because it's the Battle of Bosworth Field. You can't,
yes.
It's not the Battle of Bosworth Forest. I was just so annoyed by that. I couldn't get over it. It was really well filmed, especially the last bit where Richard is completely surrounded by enemy troops. But there's snow on the ground. Like, it just doesn't work.
Okay, in my reread of The White Queen today, there is a point, and it may have been during the Battle of Barnet, where Edward is basically has what could be a premonition of Bosworth, because he sees Richard on a battlefield surrounded, and he's saying, "York to me, Edward's not there."
I've completely forgotten about that part of the book. That's awesome. But it's this idea of the whole Wheel of Fortune, right? It, like, comes yes. for everyone. It comes for everyone. And, man, the House of York is, like, it's just, like, doomed from the get-go, right? They seem to be sort of cursed. And some of it is of their own making, of course. But there is this sort of sense of, like, doom lying over them. And everyone seems to know it. Like, everyone seems to know that these people have been, you know, they've been cursed. They're not going to make it. And it's just fascinating to me that even Margaret of Anjou says something to that effect. Like, oh, you know, when she's talking about the fortune's wheel to Anne, she seems to suggest that, you know, it's all going to come back around eventually. And yeah. at that point, of course, she has lost everything, Margaret of Anjou. So it does feel like, oh, this is just sour grapes from her. But also, there's this general feeling that she knows something, that she and Jaquetta and people of that generation know things, right? And they're just not right. able to articulate it in a way that anybody else would believe them. So, I don't know. I do find that aspect of the books really interesting. Like, she took this whole witchcraft thing and really just ran with it, you know? And it affects all the characters, except Margaret Beaufort, who is so religious that she dismisses it out of hand.
Right.
But also, I don't, like, her religiosity is portrayed as something that would have been unusual in her time, and I don't think it was. Like, her contemporaries did not view her as fanatic. She was pious in the appropriate way, you know, and because she didn't have a husband she cared for or children, it made even more sense for her to be sort of close to God, right?
Yeah, she's completely in line with her time period to me.
Yeah, so that part of the books did not make sense to me. Like, why would you portray her as being a religious fanatic when she was in fact quite normal for that time?
Yeah. Regarding Elizabeth and the witchcraft, remember when they think that the curse that they put on the line of the person or persons who killed the prince?
Right, like you will lose your own son will die or something.
Your
like
own
that.
Son will yeah. die.
And all okay. the sons die. So who is it?
Actually, I always thought the way that it is completely written, it makes it clear that it's the Tudors. Because think about it, the Tudor line dies out.
But so does the York line.
So I think she really means for it to have been Margaret Beaufort that did it.
Maybe, but I feel like it's kind of open-ended because the York line dies out too. I mean,
well, yeah, that's true.
The sons of York are dead. Edward's two sons are probably dead. Richard's son dies, and George's son dies. So it could be any of them. And Margaret's bloodline eventually dies out in the male line, anyway, right? So
right.
I don't know. It could be any of them. And we all know it was Stanley. So whoever made Stanley do it, no, I'm joking. I'm joking. It was Buckingham.
I think it was Buckingham.
We'll talk about this more when we get to our Bosworth episode. But
yes.
But yeah, so my sense is that she was really into this whole witchcraft story and she spun it well. And, you know, she says, this was recorded fact. You don't have to believe it if you don't want to, right? It's the ultimate out. Like, yes, people thought she was a witch back then, and I'm just going to use that as the premise for my story. And it does kind of work. Like, I don't think anybody walks away from these novels thinking, oh my God, this is the best historical fiction I have ever read. No one thinks that. There is the occasional turn of phrase that is really, really good and memorable. I think all three books have at least one sort of really quotable bit. And I admire her for that, but the first person narration thing did not really work for me. I understand why she did it. She had to tell the same story essentially over and over again from three different points of view. And it does sort of work because it allows you to see the different motivations of the different characters involved. But I did not enjoy the first person narration, and I didn't enjoy the book as a work of literature, even if I did find it sort of fun and entertaining as a work of historical fiction. So what's your view on that? Do you think she's a good writer, or do you think she's very popular? There's no doubt. She's among the most popular writers of historical fiction of all time. But do you think she's a good writer?
No.
Okay. Why? No, why or why not?
I will first admit I have a bias against anyone who does first person. I think first person is limiting. I would prefer to know the thoughts or point of views or, you know, motivations of multiple characters. I prefer third person omniscient. That's a personal preference, though. She, again, though, she tells a good story. She does, in a lot of cases, and again, I'm going back to Kingmaker's Daughter for this, she does keep it generally historically accurate in places. I mean, they are, Richard and Anne are at Middleham. They're not at Warwick Castle like they are in the show. So she does keep that accurate.
The show is just...
Yeah, exactly. But again, she's popular because for some reason, and I've read The Other Boleyn Girl. I've read the Boleyn book that comes after that, the title of which I cannot think of right now.
It's like The Boleyn Inheritance or something.
The Boleyn Inheritance, yes, thank you. To me, those are her two best books. I've read The Constant Princess. That is on about the same level as The White Queen and those books. Hmm. But to me, the Boleyn books are her best books.
Oh, interesting. I haven't read those, although I have seen the movies that were based on
them. The book is 100% better than the movie.
Oh, excellent. I might have to pick that up at some point. I have only read the Cousins War series. I think there is a book that in the Tudor series that features Margaret of Clarence. And I think I did start reading that, but I didn't
get very that far. One. I have read it.
And is it any good?
I have read it, but it is one of those that I have very vague memories of. So I'm going to say, no, it's not that great.
I think The White Princess.
I only have a vague memory of it. Mm-mm.
I think The White Princess is my least favorite book of the entire series, not just because of what we already discussed about her, about Elizabeth of York and Richard III, but also because it makes Elizabeth of York seem so vindictively petty in a way that I don't think is in keeping with who she was in history. And it also tries to make both a hero and a villain out of Henry Tudor. And that's a really, really hard line to walk. so I don't think she does it successfully. I think Henry VII is one of the most maligned, successful monarchs in British history. So it he needs a better biography than what Philippa Gregory can write.
I think they're going to take every Cardian cards away from us because I'm going to agree with you on Henry VII being a maligned, successful monarch. Because, yeah, he manages to, in the 24 years, I've got the math right on that. I don't know if I do because math, I like history. I don't like math. Okay? but in the time that he is king, he manages to do something that had not been done in generations. He dies in his bed and successfully transfers the throne to his son.
I know, right? Like, that's all it takes, and yet no one since Edward III had managed it.
Yeah,
and even exactly. He didn't get to leave the throne to his son. He left it to a kid, so.
He left it to his grandson, and there's the whole problem. You know, let's take a counterfactual where the Black Prince lives. I bet you if you have a counterfactual where the Black Prince lives, you don't have the Wars of the Roses.
Correct, because he's in charge and everything just flows from there. Honestly, if Richard II had just managed to have a child, you don't have the War of the Roses, so.
That's true, too. Or if he had managed to be nice to his cousin.
Yes. Or if his cousin hadn't been an asshole. Sorry for the language.
That too.
Yes. But, you know, or, you know, if Henry V hadn't just upped and died, he was a figure who united everyone around him, and everyone liked him, York and Lancaster. If he had not left his throne to a 9-month-old child, I think it would have been okay, so...
You're probably right there, too. I mean, there's plenty of places where you could counterfactually get rid of the Wars of the Roses very easily.
Right. I've heard people criticize this era of history as being of too much importance in historical fiction because it's important only to the extent that you care about people with power and money. But if you're talking about the ordinary guy in the street, his life is completely unaffected by the War of the Roses, right? It's not like the Industrial Revolution. It's not like the Reformation. It doesn't affect him at all. He's like, I don't care who king is, just as long as I get fed, right? So what do you think about the obsession that historical fiction writers of medieval fiction in particular have with this era?
In some ways, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question because historically speaking, I'm going to be honest. I care about the people that have money and power. I like political history. I don't like military history. I like political history, things such as that, diplomatic history. And to quote something I said to a professor one time, I really don't care how Jean and Marie in 13th century, you know, Provence out in their fields are doing. You know, I want to know how their monarch is doing. You know, so for me, that's, you know, my historical leanings, even reading, you know, straight history, do not go for the common people. They never have.
That's fair. And I sort of agree with you. I have read a lot of historical fiction about ordinary people, but not in this era. Because honestly, what is the entire point of the War of the Roses if we're not talking about the people who are fighting it, right? Like,
I agree.
There's that very famous painting that's inspired by the Shakespeare play where the Duke of York is so aggressively handing that rose out. And I'm like, yes, this is the whole point. These people are like, you know, he's out there putting his hand on the throne and everyone's like, oh, how dare you? And he's like, what? You don't think I'd make a great king? And then like, it's that moment at which everything falls apart. And I'm like, why would you not write about that? Honestly, I don't understand why Richard Duke of York doesn't have more fiction written about him, because he is just an absolutely fascinating guy. Like, at the age of like, by the age of like 11, he is the most powerful and the most wealthy person in all of England. Like,
exactly.
It's ridiculous, but it's just, but it happens. And then at some, and he is the first person since maybe Edward III himself in whom the effective right to the throne and the ability to actually be king kind of converge. And so, of course, he doesn't get to be king.
No, of course not. Of course not. If they had not killed him at Wakefield and he had taken the throne, then again, you may not have all of this that happened.
You don't have all of this. And Edward IV and George of Clarence and Edmund of Rutland and Richard III probably all go on to have very different lives, you know? So But he is, I guess, he lost the battle but won the war because he is, of course, the forefather of every monarch since Henry VII. So
yeah, exactly.
In a way, he won.
his bloodline still sits on the throne of England today. No, I think he would say he won.
Yes,
even if he did lose his head over it.
That's what happens when you have 10 children, though. Eventually, somebody passes down the genetic material. So,
yeah.
But I feel for Cecily Neville, Duchess of York, because she outlived all of her sons. Like, mm-hmm. That has got to be just a blow if you're a mother. And yes, I think she even outlived most of her daughters. So that's pretty rough.
I think the only daughter that actually outlives her is Margaret of Burgundy.
Yep. And Margaret was another survivor who's not had enough books written about her. She was amazing.
Exactly.
Why didn't PG pick her? Like, she's amazing. But yeah.
I will never understand. To me, if you're writing something, okay, White Queen, Red Queen. Okay, why are you doing Margaret Beaufort as Red Queen? Why are you not doing Margaret of Anjou?
Who is the actual Red Queen? Because of course, yes, Margaret Beaufort never becomes queen of anything. Yeah, that's absolutely right. It should have been Margaret of Anjou and the White Queen. Fine, that's Elizabeth Woodville. But also, Cecily, Duchess of York, doesn't get a book. And it just doesn't make sense to me. That's why I think she really did play favorites. She loved Jacquetta. She loved that story. She wanted to talk about Elizabeth of Woodville as this potential, a figure with agency, but also sort of these special supernatural powers that she maybe used for good, but also for bad. And then the other books were just sort of incidental, as in, oh, I can't not talk about Margaret Beaufort. I can't not write about Anne Neville. And so I'm going to.
Exactly.
She's clearly less interested in those books than she was in the ones about the women descended from Melusina. So
yeah. And the hilarious part of that is I think there are origin legends of the Plantagenet dynasty itself, of the Dukes of Anjou, that put them as descended from Melusina also.
Yeah, there's just so much witchcraft in that bloodline. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, somebody needs to write a really, really good like television series that's based on actual historical events from the War of the Roses. It will be better than Game of Thrones. It'll be Game of Thrones without the dragons. You know, it'll be awesome.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we will have dumb people saying, oh, they copied it from Game of Thrones. Do you remember that happened when the White Queen was first on the air?
Yes,
That first episode, and everybody was like, oh, they copied the Game of Thrones. And I was like, wait, no, do you know where Game of Thrones got the idea for these warring families? Like, it's not even hidden. They're literally called Stark and Lannister. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, how do you not see that Stark and Lannister are York and Lancaster? And I'm saying someone who has watched exactly one episode of Game of Thrones.
And the writer is not at all shy about the fact that those are the historical antecedents for the two families in the Game of Thrones. And yet people who had only seen the TV show were like, oh, they copied Game of Thrones.
Well, I think, too, the whole red wedding in Game of Thrones is also from something that happens in, I want to say, medieval Scotland.
Yes, it's Scotland. And yes, again, the author is not shy about admitting that that is the inspiration for that scene. But I just find it so strange that people don't relate real history to things that fictional histories are drawn from, which kind of brings us full circle in this episode, in the sense that if history operates as fiction, some people are going to confuse fiction with actual history. So, you know, there are going to be people who believe that the things that happened in Philippa Gregory's novels actually did happen in history. Some things did, and some things didn't. So yeah, with history as fiction, you always have to be a little bit careful.
I mean, there is, anytime you watch something that a movie, think about the disclaimer that's in front of a movie. All of these characters are fictional. Nothing is taken from historical. Do you know the reason there is that?
Lawyers.
Yes, but do you know the specific reason?
No.
Okay, this is where my love of Russia comes in. Felix Yusupov, one of the murderers of Rasputin, you know, he's married to Nicholas II's niece, Irina. There is a movie made in the early 1930s, late 1920s, about the murder of Rasputin. He does not like the way that he or Irina are portrayed in it. He sues them over it. And that is the whole reason it is there.
So it is lawyers, but in a sort
of
more
vindictive
way.
Yeah, it is lawyers, but there also is a historical person who is the reason.
How interesting. We used to have this debate on Tumblr all the time about whether you could say malicious things about Henry Tudor or Richard III or really any of these figures. And so people would be like, their feelings would be hurt. I'm like, no, they've been dead for more than 500 years. They have no feelings. They're just dust at this point, you know?
And yeah, they've been dead for 500 years. It doesn't matter. You're not going to malign them by whatever you say. You're not going to say anything that's worse than what has been said about them before.
Already, exactly. And honestly, there's no concept of defamation against the dead. You cannot defame a dead person because they have no public reputation. So
exactly.
And again, these people have been dead for 500 years. They are beyond the realm of caring about what people think about them. So there's just no there, and I encourage everyone to have as many wild and speculative historical opinions as they possibly can, because that means they're interested. And on that note, I want to read a quote from Philippa Gregory. She actually published a series of essays as a companion piece to The White Queen, and in it she says, "To me, these women are interesting as individuals. They are my heroines. They are my foremothers. If a woman is interested in her own struggle into identity and power, then she will be interested in other women. The lives of these and other women show what a woman can do even without formal power, education, or rights in a world dominated by men. They are inspirational examples of the strength of the female spirit." So that is how Philippa Gregory felt about the women she wrote about. Did she actually succeed in demonstrating them as examples of the female spirit?
Yes and no. In some ways she did, but in other ways she turns them into either these very paranoid women, although of course you're completely seeing it from their point of view and you understand why they have the paranoia, or into this religious fanatic, or into this witch who, you know, seems to be maneuvering everything, who seems to be the spider drawing everybody into her web. So, I mean, yeah, she does, but she also doesn't.
So I think what she succeeds in doing is maybe portraying them as sort of real people, right? They have they have good attributes, but they have bad ones too. And they're quite relatable in some of their paranoia. But she doesn't make them feel especially inspirational, even though she is personally inspired by their stories. So I think maybe that's... I don't want to call it a failure exactly, because I think she did what she set out to do, which was she wanted to entertain people with stories of figures they were probably not familiar with from just having read history books. And in that sense, she was quite successful. But I think in the whole, are you writing about women being inspirational as inspirational figures? I would say no.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't see anything inspirational about any of them. And that includes even Jaquetta. Jaquetta actually is probably the best of all of them. But I'm still not certain I see anything inspirational about her.
I suppose it's inspirational that she went off and did what she wanted to do without worrying about what the consequences were going to be. So in that sense.
Yeah, in that sense, yes.
But I think, I mean, for me, the most inspirational of these women, as seen through the eyes of actual history, is Margaret Beaufort, just because she is a survivor. And I mean, if the English counselors of the time had not been so hell-bent on having a male king, there was no reason they couldn't have put Margaret on the throne. She had the appropriate bloodlines, and she had a ton of money and support from her Beaufort relatives. She could have done it. Or they could have made her off to Edward IV, and you know, it would have solved the whole War of the Roses problem right away.
Yeah, marrying her to Edward would have solved it, yes.
They were almost the same age, so it would have been perfect.
I would argue, though, given that the Beauforts are an illegitimate line, that no, she did not have the proper bloodline.
I think, though, that is open to interpretation. Like, I know Henry IV's thing was, yeah, you can be my legitimate siblings, but you are legally ineligible to sit on the throne was a thing that was never within his power to do, even as king. So I think, of course, Henry Tudor was quite careful to not claim those Beaufort bloodlines and just say, no,
right, Henry was
by conquest. I won fair and square, I'm king now. And he didn't really care about the whole bloodline thing. And then he married Elizabeth of York anyway, so that any of their children would be seen as the appropriate heirs to the Yorkist line as well. And that's fine. But I do think that, I mean, or even Elizabeth of York, if they hadn't been so hell-bent on putting a man on the throne, she was next in line. She should have been on the throne. Henry the Seventh should have legitimated her and made her queen, you know?
What's the difference between Elizabeth of York and her granddaughters?
She didn't know. That's the difference.
Yeah, true.
Even Henry VIII didn't actually want that, right? He didn't actually want his daughters to come to the throne, which is why he was so excited about the birth of his one surviving son. But
right. Yeah. But his daughters come to the throne because there is no other surviving male heir. There's no other surviving male heir at the time when, you know,
everybody had to be a man, exactly. But I gotta say, both, I mean, and we're going way off the page now because this is no longer about the War of the Roses or Philippa Gregory's books. But I find it so interesting that both Mary and Elizabeth were so much more capable than their brother to rule, and yet were sidelined just because of their gender. And bringing this back full circle, I think that is also a problem with historical fiction in this era. A lot of it is written by women, and a lot of it is written for consumption by women. So there's a bigger focus on romance over, say, political intrigue or battle or whatever it is that drives historical fiction in other eras. And I think because of that, these works are often dismissed by people who are very serious about their literature or very serious about this, about their history, as not being important. And I sort of resent that. I think there's a huge issue with fiction written by women being dismissed as less important than fiction written by men. And that's not even taking into account the specific problems that women of color have in having their accounts taken seriously. Yeah. Even aside from that, I think that, like, we've read the line in Charles Ross's biography of Richard III, right, where he describes a lot of modern amateur historians as basically little old ladies writing romance novels, right? And I think that's...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it is an extremely sexist view to take, and I do think that Philippa Gregory's novels, which are often criticized for being ahistorical, are... That criticism is partly grounded in sexism because she is a woman writing about women. But, I mean, her stories are also not particularly historical. So in that sense, there is some validity to the criticism. But I think some of it does come from a place of sexism. And I really wish we could get away from that and view not only these historical figures who are women as being important, but also view the people who write about them as being more interested in telling me stories than in just a romance novel, right? I think that we need to get away from viewing all of this only through the lens of the romance novel. There are great, great writers of historical fiction out there who are very good at what they do, at their craft, including PG herself. And we don't need to relegate them to the sort of junk heap of historical romance. We can take them seriously. We can read their books. We can value it as entertainment and as literature, and maybe even as the first step into studying the history of a particular era.
I agree. I mean, PG would not be a best-selling novelist if she were absolutely horrid. I mean, she does write decently. I mean, we all have different opinions of what we like and what we don't like. But there also is, when it comes to historians looking at historical fiction, yeah, there is sexism involved. There is sexism because it's most historical fiction, but honestly, let's just be honest, most fiction these days is written for women. And therefore, it's not considered as, I don't know the word I'm wanting to search for here, but it's not considered as important.
Yeah, there's a value judgment.
As the historical monograph.
Right. Which is too bad because most monographs are super, super dry and boring. Like,
exactly.
if you could use Philippa Gregory's writing style to write a monograph about Elizabeth Woodville, it would be a better book than the actual biographies of Elizabeth Woodville.
Right, exactly. And Elizabeth Woodville is actually one that we know enough about to fill a biography of. Anne Neville is not.
That's true. That's part of the problem with writing any biography of Anne Neville. It's ultimately a biography of a generic woman who lived in the late 15th century instead of specifically Anne. And I don't understand why there's so little information about her. She must have written letters, like, during her life, right? She must have written letters. She must have engaged in accounts with locals in Middleham and in York. I mean, she must have been engaged with the church. All the things that a duchess with money and influence would have done in her time. She must have entertained guests at Middleham. And we don't have records of any of that. And it's just odd. The only thing I can think of is that it was all destroyed somehow, deliberately or with the passage of time, and no one cared to save it before it was too late.
Some of her records as queen could have been destroyed when she died, if what she died of was tuberculosis.
That's true.
Some of her personal effects there could have been destroyed. Okay, if you take everything being back up at Middleham, and then once Henry VII comes into power, that's not a castle that is used. In fact, I think I've read basically it was ruined during the Civil War in the 1600s. So if you take going through that and going on, and then there's just the fact that she is Richard III's wife, the very maligned, very perceived as villainous Richard III. So it does make sense that a lot is lost. But it does seem that there still should be more.
There ought to be more. And there is, again, we're going kind of away from PG's work, but one of the things that stands out in The Kingmaker's Daughter is that even though Anne is married to this very wealthy man and she's now a royal duchess and all that, she doesn't do very much. She's not sort of active in the running of Richard's estates. And there is a suggestion in the novel that this is deliberate on Richard's part, that he's trying to kind of sideline her in the same way that Anne Beauchamp basically gets locked away by Richard and Anne in a way that allows him to be more powerful, but ultimately kind of cuts her out of the corridors of power. Anne is very clear that she's not interested in power, but I also think that that is maybe Philippa Gregory reacting to general theory in the academic world that Richard kind of deliberately didn't allow her to exercise any of her own power. He did not assign her lands when they were married. He did not give her the power to run the estate as many other women of her station had done traditionally at that time. So maybe Philippa Gregory picked up on that in The Kingmaker's Daughter, which is why Anne seems somewhat passive relative to the other characters in the other books.
That could be.
You also, though, in the way that Philippa Gregory has written them, it's not an equal partnership in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And I just don't think that we have a way of knowing one way or the
other.
We
don't.
When it comes to them.
And all of these missing records don't make it any easier, right?
Yeah.
So one last question before we wrap up. If you were writing the series instead of Philippa Gregory, what would you do differently?
I think we've answered this a little bit. Because I definitely would have made Margaret Beaufort, not Margaret Beaufort as the Red Queen, that would have been Margaret of Anjou. And it's not that Margaret Beaufort is not an interesting character. It's not that she does not have a lot to do with the Wars of the Roses. She does. But if you are again calling it Red Queen, White Queen, okay, the one that is crowned as a queen is Margaret of Anjou, not Margaret Beaufort. And also, I just think a good Susan Higginbotham's novel aside, that there needs to be a decent Margaret of Anjou novel.
I agree.
And I actually think Gregory probably would have done a more unbiased Margaret of Anjou novel than Higginbotham did.
That's fair. I actually am still really surprised that she didn't round out the Cousins War series by writing about Margaret of Anjou, even though Margaret's life is effectively captured in The Lady of the Rivers. I guess she and Jaquetta were close, and so that becomes an aspect of the friendship. But if I were writing the series, I would write it chronologically by starting with either Cecily Neville or Jaquetta of Luxembourg, and then moving on to Margaret of Anjou, and then down the road. I do think Elizabeth Woodville deserves a novel. She's interesting in her own right. The back end of her life is much more interesting than the front end, I think, but still quite interesting. I don't know if I would have written about Anne Neville. I think there isn't enough information about her to ground a great novel on, and I think her life is very short, which is unfortunate. And invariably, any writing about Anne Neville becomes a novel about Richard III, and we have enough of those already. So I would have left her. I would have left her completely alone and focused on Elizabeth of York and probably Margaret of Clarence, because I think she lived a really interesting life and had a sort of really interesting end of her life as well when she was basically in conflict with Henry VIII. So
yes.
So I would have written about her, and I would have left. Both Margaret Beaufort and Neville.
If you're writing about Margaret of Clarence and you start it in Margaret's childhood, then you get Anne into that novel. If you were writing about the others, if you're writing about Elizabeth Woodville, if you're writing about Margaret Beaufort, you don't avoid Anne and Richard. Didn't necessarily have to have their own book because, I mean, look at the brevity of the reign. It's 2 years.
The other interesting figure from that era that I might have wanted to write a novel about is Anne's mother, the Countess of Warwick, Anne Beauchamp, because she was a piece of work, but also so fascinating. Like, why on earth did she turn tail and run? She can't have wanted to save herself that much, but, you know, I don't know. I want to know where her motivations are. She was born wealthy, and she basically passed that title and that wealth on to her husband.
The title comes Warwick from her. Via her.
Comes from her. She is the countess in her own right of Warwick, and he gets all of that money from her. And in fact, there's a huge problem with the Neville inheritance in that it is quite large and involves several very large northern properties, but it is entailed in the main line. And technically, Anne and Isabel cannot inherit because they are not male heirs of their father. And so the only way Richard is able to get that land is via a grant from the king. And I find that so interesting because the only way Anne can get her hands on the Warwick money is if her mother dies. So she has her mother declared dead by Parliament so that she can take her money. I find it so mercenary, but so practical and real. Like, what else are you supposed to do? This woman just won't die, so I can't get her money. until she pops off.
And then also, honestly, when Anne probably needed her mother the most, at the point that her father has been killed, her mother runs off to an abbey and puts herself into sanctuary there.
That's the thing I don't understand. Like, what was she trying to protect there? She's not protecting her daughter. She is not protecting her estates, which are almost certainly going to be taken away from her because her husband is under a bill of attainder. So I don't understand why she ran off.
And why would she have thought anything would have happened to her? I mean, Edward is not his grandson. He doesn't execute women.
And also, she's his cousin. Like, I mean, these people are related. It's not like Edward personally kills Warwick either. He might have let Warwick go if Warwick hadn't died in battle. I mean, you know, it's these people were, I mean, that's the thing that we don't get, is that Warwick was literally like his best friend. So to be betrayed by your best friend and your younger brother is a big blow.
And then you let your younger brother live. You forgive your younger brother when he, you know, comes back. You forgive him. You let him live. Yeah, I actually see him letting Warwick live.
And maybe banishing him to some terrible place and taking all his lands away, but
yeah, letting him live.
Yeah.
Because honestly, that would have been more punishment.
And that is how Edward operates. Like, he's not just, let me ruthlessly murder everybody in front of me. He's more what's in it for me. So, No, he's a fascinating person who deserves to have more books written about him. Goodness. I mean, Edward IV is really, really fascinating. It's too bad that...
I think when we discuss certain other books...
Yes.
That Edward will come up in those.
Yes, definitely.
One of those, and you know the one I mean.
Yes. He will come up. He's a big character in those novels. So yes, he will. Anything else you would like to add about Philippa Gregory and the Cousins War series or history as fiction?
You know, I kept thinking, knowing we were going to do this, I kept thinking, trying to realize when I started to love historical fiction. And honestly, it was in elementary school. It was in elementary school. It was, laughably enough, the Little House on the Prairie series.
Of course.
So, I mean, I think that if you want to have people love history, you have to realize that history in and of itself is the story of the people who have lived in the past. And then once you realize that, and then once you read about them, you realize, oh, wait a minute, they're really not that much different from us.
Yes, exactly. That there's things we can learn from their lives, but also that their lives are perfectly relatable to us, even if they lived in a completely different time and era. And I do think you're right in that the people who get into historical fiction are those who started doing it relatively early in life when they were still very impressionable. Like, I started reading historical fiction when I was probably 11 or 12, and I couldn't tell you what the first book was anymore, but it was almost certainly something like Call of the Wild or Red Badge of Courage or something like that, but something that was set in a different time than the one we were living in.
Right.
And I think that really influenced me, and it made me really interested in storytelling. Because the stories you tell about things that can't be verified are the most interesting kind of stories. It's why I love historical fiction, but it's also why I love fantasy literature and sci-fi and all of that kind of stuff. So I think the speculative aspect of it really appeals to me. And I think that it is a really good entry into real history. Like, if you're interested in real history, start with fiction and then move forward, you know?
Yeah, because that's pretty much exactly what I did. I started with fiction and then I moved into real history.
Oh, there you go. The historians of tomorrow are the story readers and tellers of today.
Exactly.
And on that note, thank you for joining us for this episode of Plantagenet Shade. We'll be back next month with a new episode. Join us for this episode. Subscribe, listen. We are available on all the podcast platforms that you would normally listen to your favorite podcasts on.
Yes, and we look forward to, shall we say, seeing you next month.
Yes. Feel free to subscribe and please leave us comments on Twitter. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.